Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Our thanks to this week's sponsor, Bonningale Nurseries at Wolverhampton.
There is no better group of plants for flower power than forms of the shrubby potentilla, producing single rose-like flowers continually from June to the first frost.
Hello and welcome to This Week in the Garden. I'm Peter Seabrook, here to exchange some news, views, a bit of seasonal advice and hopefully answer a few gardening quandaries along the way. As so often the weather dictates activities, and that east wind was a killer for several days, although we did miss the damaging gales last weekend that many down the east coast had to suffer. Indeed, last Saturday it was dry enough to cut the lawns. Not as dry as I would like, but at least it's now cut, and with low temperatures should be okay for a good few weeks now. On Monday, it was so cold, water and the soil remained frozen all day, and the thermometer dropped to -5 in the polytunnel. That saw off the tomato foliage, although there are still some trusses of green fruit I can cut off and tray up, and they'll ripen in the kitchen. Should certainly see me through to the new year with a bit of luck. The bed of roses planted a year or so ago in the front was getting a bit tall, so all but the budded stems were cut back by a third. The surface weeded, fallen leaves gathered before I applied a mulch of oak leaf mould among the emerging cyclamen coombe foliage. Oh, and there were the first signs of pink flower buds just popping up. John and I managed to clear the front drive from all the pots, trays and other debris that had accumulated, a fair bit of it, I have to say, from the September Chelsea flower show. You know, it's surprising how much has to be cleared up and how long it takes to do. But on Sunday I had a day off and journeyed to Wotton-on-Stone near Stevenage, where I was invited to an excellent Sunday lunch. All allotment-grown produce. My hosts have a new house with the sitting room on the first floor, lots of large glass windows looking out across the village sports field to the church, on a beautiful place to sit on a bright, sunny, late November day. On return home, I picked a lovely handful of raspberries from the polytunnel. Surely this must be the last lot for 2021. What's the news this week? Well, the large chain of British garden centres are donating 50 pence from every fresh-cut Christmas tree sold towards making Christmas a little better for all youngsters at 52 children's hospices. Boy, that should bring a few more smiles. A staff and customers had some fun recently at Perrywood Sudbury Garden Centre when the Aladdin pantomime characters from the local theatre made an appearance. Apparently, Perrywood staff tested the magic carpet and Aladdin and Humphrey the camel entertained everybody to some extent. I hear that the BBC has signed a new 3-year contract with the Royal Horticultural Society for exclusive coverage of their shows. Chelsea show will be a standalone series of programmes as usual, while Hampton Court, Tatton and Malvern Spring Festival will be broadcast by the BBC Two Gardeners World programme. Questions? Well, the burning question over recent weeks has been winter treatment for begonias and dahlias. Chris Bradley tells me that we've had over 100,000 hits for this subject on the sungardening.co.uk gardening how-to videos. Now frost has burnt the foliage and stems back. They should fall off begonia tubers. So once this happens, carefully remove any compost or soil without damaging the skin if you can. Let them dry and then store them in paper bags in a frost-free place. Dahlias should similarly be cut back to 6 inches, lifted, soil or compost carefully removed, and then stacked upside down to dry before again storing either in single layers in trays or in paper bags. Now my interview this week is Barbara Wright. She's a real expert in micropropagation and has been doing that for years. When you microprop, it's an alternative to growing from seeds or cuttings, where we actually start with a tiny piece of plant cell from the growing tip. A much more technical way of growing, and not for the amateur, obviously. But growing new plants in this way allows very rapid multiplication. You know, from one little tip, you can have hundreds and thousands in a very short time. The image of microprop plants is quite futuristic looking. You know, plants in glass jars, growing away and multiplying on a clear agar, no soil. If you've got an orchid on the windowsill, there's a very good chance that it started life in this way, and also that you paid less for it, thanks to the speed and great numbers that can be produced in this way. As well as the obvious financial benefits of growing plants more quickly, we can also grow them disease-free. It's a good way to eliminate virus from strawberries, croissants, all those kinds of things. It's a very interesting topic, so I wanted to ask Barbara to tell us just a bit more about it.
So, Peter, it's very much a sterile technique. We actually propagate it in a laboratory. So conventionally, plants have been micropropagated for 40 years plus. It's growing plants in sterile cultures. So we use honey jars with a medium. So we would actually give the plants all the nutrients they'd need to grow in, rather than them having their roots in the soil or compost or whatever. We actually have to supply all that to them. But it allows us to perhaps tweak plant growth hormones. And that's really the advantage of micropropagation.
And you start with a very tiny piece of each plant, don't you?
Yes, yeah, very, very tiny piece, yeah, yeah. It used to be easier in the old days when we had better eyesight.
And so why is this necessary?
Okay, so we have to start with a tiny piece so that it's as sterile as it can be from the apical bud. But one of the advantages, really, of micropropagation and needing a very small amount of material is that we don't need much. So over the years, we have often been able to multiply up new plants for launching to the public. I mean, you mentioned the hop golden tassels. That was one of them, where there's just maybe one or two stock plants initially, and then we can multiply up and produce 5,000, 10,000, however many is required.
And they tend to be cleaner, don't they, if they're propagated in this way?
Yes, they do. They're cleaner. It gives us a chance to lose the fungi bacteria that tend to sit on the surface of a plant. And also, micropropagation does tend to rejuvenate plants. It gives them more vigour, generally.
And when you started out from a university, you were doing roses, I think, micropropagating roses. Was that the start crop?
That was very much where we established the business, yes, yeah, yeah. So, micropropagation allowed us to produce roses that are on their own roots rather than having to be grafted.
But you've made quite a dramatic change. The name of the company now, Beedamos. Can you explain that a little to us?
Yeah. So it has been a bit of a transition and a journey. We were asked to do moorland plants, so things like bilberries and crowberries and cotton grasses, the things that you would find on peatlands on our moors, because they were quite hard to do from seed on a big scale. So we started with that, and then from that we developed into actually being asked to propagate sphagnum moss, which is unique to peatlands.
From my point of view, sphagnum moss is sphagnum moss, but I rather gather there are a whole series of species of sphagnum mosses and that you propagate quite a variety of them.
It's fascinating. It's like all subjects, Peter. The more you get into something, the more it's fascinating, the more you learn. We routinely have about 20 different species that we propagate. In our lab, we have probably a total of about 40 or 50 different species.
Of sphagnum mosses?
Of sphagnum moss.
40?
Unbelievable,
40
isn't it?
40 or 50? Why? Do different sphagnums grow better in certain areas and conditions?
Very, very much so. So we have species from around the world. So different species are found in different countries. They're quite habitat-specific and climatically limited. But in this country, we have a huge diversity of species. Some are associated with our upland blanket bogs, so up in the Yorkshire Dales, Cumbria, the Peak District. And even up there, there are some that form hummocks, and then there are some that are found more in the flushes, the more, relatively nutrient-rich areas of bog. And then we have species that are more associated with fenlands.
And so the fenland ones, they would be raised bogs?
Yes.
As we get on the latitude that goes across from sort of Yorkshire to Lancashire and then to Ireland, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. We have raised bogs and then the more true fen type of environment.
And so when you open your honey jar, which has, who knows, 50 or 100 or more of these little tiny propagules, then what happens to them and how do you get them out onto a hillside for blanket bog or something like that?
Yeah, so obviously we have to sort of make a transition from that kind of quite nurtured environment in the lab. We then grow them in our greenhouse. So we now have about 2 hectares of greenhouse here in East Leake, full of sphagnum moss growing away. And we sort of harden that up. But then, yes, then it does have to make the transition out into the harsh, real world of the peatland.
And is it on its own or is it in pots or how do you handle it?
Okay, so we actually handle it in small handfuls. They're little small clumps of moss. So there's perhaps about 50, 100, 150 strands of moss in a handful, in a clump. And we actually package that up so that it's quite easy to handle when you're out on a peatland doing some planting for restoration. You can kind of unroll them quite easily. But then they are hand plantable. You just make a little hole with a dibber, put your little clump of sphagnum in and heel it in with your boot and there you go, it's away and growing.
And presumably it will then need moisture.
Yeah. I think that's one thing is that at least naturally most peatlands are heavily associated with a lot of rain.
Yeah, yes.
So the moisture, the moisture comes quite naturally.
Yeah. And how quickly, if you go out onto a hillside and you need to reintroduce the sphagnum moss growth, how quickly will it spread? What sort of depths might you get in given time?
So a lot of our little clumps get planted in sort of February or March time. And often at the end of a growing season, they can be plate-sized, if not dinner plate-sized. So they grow very quickly and start to spread. There isn't a whole lot of information as yet on how quickly that sphagnum starts to contribute to peat formation. But there is a lot of work being done on the carbon benefits. You know, the big move to restoring our peatlands is that the peatlands emit a lot of carbon dioxide because our blanket bogs are very degraded and damaged over time by industrial pollution or agricultural practices. So, for example, in this country, it's thought that damaged peatlands actually contribute about 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions from the land use sector. So they're a very significant proportion, even though they're a very small area of our country.
But some of your species of sphagnum are quite good at growing quite quickly, I understand, and absorbing quite a lot of carbon dioxide.
That's right. I think sphagnum is a very underrated plant in our fight against climate change. You know, it's so tiny, most people don't see it. You just walk over it. So in comparison to sort of walking through a woodland or a forest, which, you know, everyone sees the trees. But in fact, globally, peatlands store twice as much carbon as all the forests in the world, which is quite an amazing statistic.
It is an amazing statistic, yeah.
It's just the little forgotten thing in our whole climate viewpoint.
It's a long time ago since I was walking about on raised bog in Ireland in this particular case, and there I was told off for actually walking on raised bog because once you tread on sphagnum and exude the air, it could take, they told me, 5 to 10 years before it got back to growing in the normal rapid way that it would.
I think that's where we feel that being able to micropropagate the sphagnum is so important, because obviously the existing peatlands with sphagnum, it is a very sensitive ecological system, as you say, and so we do need to keep those intact and preserved. So the ability to supply sphagnum produced sustainably, produced by micropropagation, without having to damage any of those peatlands, is actually a really valuable contribution. It means we can go and plant sphagnum all over, wherever it's needed, without damaging those existing bogs.
Do you see that you have export opportunities? Then you talk about having all those different species. I noticed that in Lithuania, for example, they're reseeding damaged bog, and there they're talking about 5 to 7 centimetres depth of growth a year once that it's established. So will Beta Moss be sending its micropropagated species around the world?
Yeah, we very much hope so. We are currently exporting to Germany. We're very pleased there to be, you know, supporting restoration there. And again, yes, the Baltic states are probably in need of material. We're working with Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. Everywhere there's peatland, there's a need for sphagnum.
Barbara, it's fascinating to speak to you and to hear that story. And what surprises me is that, you know, I jog through life trying my best to keep in touch with everything. And then people that I know quite well, working away, not so very many counties away, doing work that I had no idea about. You know, why don't we talk to one another more?
I think one of the really interesting things that Neil and I find, Peter, is that our business has been very much based in horticulture. Originally, we were producing ornamental plants, and we find ourselves kind of coming full circle back to that. Because one of the other big uses for sphagnum is actually as a use in growing media, as a potential peat replacement. So it's quite interesting to be coming full circle, and we find ourselves talking to people that we knew years ago as they're doing trials with our new product. It's It's really quite lovely.
So are we going to see sphagnum farming then? I think I have heard a little bit of that being done in China, but I hadn't thought about it in the UK.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of interest in that. There's a lot of interest from DEFRA looking at paludiculture, wet crops as alternatives. Yeah, and sphagnum farming, there will be a big market for it. A lot of people are interested. Horticulture is a very technical industry. I think a lot of people maybe don't appreciate how technically challenging it is. And to get the right growing media is so key to a lot of horticultural processes, especially plug plant production, propagation that we've always been associated with.
I say amen to that, yeah. Barbara, you know, it's lovely to speak to you. Hope I may call in and actually see greenhouses full of sphagnum in the not-too-distant future.
Oh, yes, Peter. Oh, yes. Please do.
The tailpiece? Well, I went to a funeral this week for Bill Hamblin. And his daughter Sue told us, "One of the happiest people I have known, always smiling, never defeated or upset. When slugs attacked his potatoes and fly destroyed the carrots on his allotment, he shrugged and said, 'Yes, but we had fun doing it, didn't we?' Farewell, Bill. It was good to have enjoyed your company and your smiles, as did many that packed the church to say their goodbyes. Keep gardening, and I very much hope you have fun doing it. Join you next week." Our thanks to this week's sponsor, Bonningale Nurseries at Wolverhampton, to my producer, Rich Jarman, and to you for listening.
Producing single rose like flowers continually from June to the first frost. All not very easy to grow in any garden, but the best results are obtained in light of every soil.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.